Brahmachalohokaha dipati sahampati kahatang jalihiyahan adiwarang ayachata santi dasahataha paraja kajatika Dese tudahamahang anukampimang pajang.
Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. So, opportunity on this special day, requesting a reflection, a desana, and we chanted the Namajaka Pavatana Sutta in the beginning. That's the first sermon the Buddha gave after his enlightenment, and then meditation. And so this is just to reflect, to consider what we're actually doing, what is happening. Are we celebrating just a historical event, or is it much more than that? Is it just a reflection on the past, or bring it into the present? Because the Dhammajaka Sutta was the teaching of the Four Noble Truths. And this teaching is, this is my opinion, is a perfect teaching. He started out with a perfect teaching, not just a beginner's luck. It was beautifully prepared and marvelously delivered, and we've kept that in this tradition for all the 2,557 years, this great teaching. After the Buddha was enlightened, as it is written in the scripture, in the suttas, his first thought was that what he realized, what he saw, his awakening, was impossible to describe or put into words. So he assumed there was no point in even trying to do it, you know. Nobody would understand what he was talking about. And then as the scripture, the Brahma Sahampani, the Brahma God came and requested that he go and teach for those with only a little dust in their eyes, which means that there's some way to present this in a way that is not just based on a personal experience or on some kind of doctrinal position. And so when the Buddha met his five friends, disciples in Saranat, this is the sermon that they were curious to find out what he discovered, because they had kind of deserted him when they thought he was not really performing his ascetic duties to the standard that they held very high. And the Buddha actually, this was before he was the Buddha, realized that just concentrating the mind, refining conditioned phenomena, isn't really the solution to the problem of human suffering. It's not liberating. It's a temporary relief. And so when he left his five friends and went off to Bodh Gaya, sat under the Bodhi tree, what did he actually realize? What happened there? And instead of trying to concentrate the mind and trying to attain anything or get anything or control anything, he no doubt just reflected on the way things are. And of course, There's famous murals and that of the attacks of Mara, all the temptations, and from everything from the most pleasant to the most frightening. But the Buddha, in the traditional way, and when pictured in murals in Thailand, he's sitting just as this Buddha Rupa is here, sitting and not shutting his eyes, not trying to shut anything away, but merely witnessing the movement of sankharas, which would be in forms of devadas, beautiful people, ugly people, frightening ones, devils, angels, whatever. So that is that says that what he actually experienced was to just be aware of the movement and changing conditions that he experienced at that time in that place. So when he went to Varanasi and gave the first sermon, he started out with the most banal, the most ordinary experience all humanity could ever have or assume is the suffering, or dukkha is the Pali word, but it means dissatisfaction, unhappiness, worry, anxiety, all the things we create in our minds about, around our physical forms, about our bodies, about sensory experience. And this dukkha, or this suffering, then is changed from being something he's trying to get rid of and run away from or deny or destroy, but he understands it. And to understand anything, clearly you have to accept it for what it is. You can't really understand Dhamma if you're always trying to find it. Or if you're trying to get rid of suffering just by seeking happiness, or trying to find pleasure, sensual pleasures, or some kind of sense of security in wealth or position. So that this running away from dukkha is changed and put into the context of a noble truth, an Aryan truth, Aryasatya. And so then we ask ourselves, what's so noble about suffering? You know, why did the Buddha take something nobody wants, we all don't want, we would like to get rid of, and put it in that category of noble truth? And so is there something noble about suffering? Or is the nobility about our attitude, our changing from one who's just seeking security through illusions, through fear, through desire, towards understanding? And then, as I said before, to understand something, you must accept it, you know, and not try to change it, but just recognize it. There is this suffering, and that's the first noble truth. Now, noble truth is not ultimate truth. So it's not a kind of ultimate proclamation of life is a miserable experience. It's not a pessimistic teaching in any way, but pointing to something that we can all easily recognize. Everybody suffers, whether, you know, no matter what your position, wealthy or poor, male or female, through all time, through, you know, the first human beings to the present ones sitting here. Suffering is now realized, recognized. There is suffering. And what do we do about it? Is to understand it. So in the formula that the Buddha used of the Four Noble Truths, there's four truths proclaimed and then three aspects to each truth. And those three aspects is a reflective way of looking. It's like the first noble truth, there is suffering, is what we call bariyati dhamma. It's what we get from the scripture when we chant the Dhammajakkappavattana Sutta. You know, we get that out of the chanting book or out of the Tripitaka. And then the Bhatibhattā is the second aspect, which is what to do about it. You know, it's not just saying there is suffering and leaving that, but what should we do about this suffering? What is there to do? How to practice with it? And that is to understand. So understanding in this sense means not to try to figure out why I suffer, you suffer, or why there is suffering, but to recognize suffering as you change your attitude of just seeing it as something you don't want to, understanding it, looking at it, admitting it, even embracing it, noticing suffering is like this. And so this is a shift, a change of direction from the common, ordinary human being who's seeking happiness and trying to find security by trying to control and get rid of everything they don't like or don't want, to understanding, towards turning to suffering, seeing it as a noble truth rather than as a nasty fact of life. Now, there's something noble in that. When we do that, then we're no longer expecting to find happiness and then blaming the world or the government or husband, wife, or children for our unhappiness, like we tend to do when we're just caught in trying to get rid of it. We don't want to suffer. We'd like the American government to make everything perfect for us so we don't have any problems. We'd like to have perfect parents, teachers, situations that will make us feel secure, safe, and happy. And as long as we make that demand in this realm, we're going to be very disappointed, because this realm is not about that. This realm is a realm of continuous, inexorable changingness. Conditioned phenomena, its very nature is change, impermanence. That includes our bodies, of course, our physical forms. It includes everything we experience through the senses, experience all our emotional habits, memories, thoughts, everything. When we examine it, when we look at it in terms of a noble truth, we see its very nature is to change. So even happiness in the present moment, if we have this moment as a very happy moment, we would like to have it stay this way, but happiness is not a sustainable possibility. It's a changing condition. And so worldly happiness and beauty and pleasure, sensual pleasures, and all these are not, you can't sustain them for very long. They are pleasant and they give us a sense of feeling happy and successful and so forth, but you can't sustain it. Well, the third aspect of the First Noble Truth is the insight. Bhatiwait Dhamma, which is meaning, Bhatiwait is the actual insight, experience, suffering has been understood. So notice these three aspects. This is a brilliant way of pointing out something that will really help us. Make a statement, there is what to do about it, understand it. And then through our understanding, we have the insight. Yes, there is suffering. It's no longer just grasping the Bariyati statement, because the Buddha said there's suffering. We're not just grasping that. There's a way to recognize it, realize it yourself. And that's through understanding, looking at it, not as something external, but, in your own consciousness, conscious experience in the present. For example, right now, the cold wind, we could create suffering around the weather. And we think the weather's making me suffer. But no, it's just, weather's like this, and the body's like this, and the feeling is like this. And the suffering is not wanting it to be cold, wanting to get warm. We create that. That's something we do. We don't create the weather. You know, it is what it is. But we create the desire. If the temperatures are what we like, then we want to have it, sustain it, and keep it that way. Or if it's cold and we're feeling chilly or whatever, then we want to change the weather or go to someplace warm. So this is actually observed. It's not something that is mystical or hard to recognize. It's just generally not noticed because our habit tendencies are always toward trying to get away and blaming our feeling of discomfort on weather rather than on our own mental creation, our reaction to it. The second noble truth, then, is the cause of suffering. Suffering is an ultimate kind of metaphysical, eternal reality. It has an origin. So because of this origin, then it's based on not understanding dukkha, not understanding suffering. Then but through not understanding suffering, we have this avijja, or this ignorance of this suffering. So we're merely caught in ignorance of suffering and the attachment to the desire. So we have desire and attachment. We have these three things that are the cause of suffering: ignorance, not knowing the noble truths, the desire that arises out of that ignorance that we attach to, cling to, hold to, and that is the cause of suffering. So this is an emphasis on the word dhanha, or desire. In English, we translate that as this dhanha, as desire. And I don't know about you, but my impression from my background is that desire isn't a very nice thing, you know. You say somebody has a lot of desires, it's not exactly flattering them. They might be very good desires, and this is one thing. Desires aren't all bad or coarse or anything. They can be refined. They can wanting to become enlightened, wanting to attain high levels of concentration, wanting to be refined, wanting to become a stream enterer or an arahant. I mean, these are good desires, but they're still desires. And so we can begin to awaken to desire, not as something to suppress anymore, but to recognize. And the Buddha makes it very clear, these desires, gamma dhanha, is like sensual desire, desire for beautiful things to see, or beautiful sounds, or taste, touch, all the pleasures of the senses. This is a desire realm. We're living in a desire world. You know, the bodies we have are desire bodies. And the senses we have, you know, they create this sense of wanting the beautiful, the refined, the good, and not wanting the bad, the coarse, the ugly. So there's gamadana, pavadana, desire to become something. So, you know, we start out meditation usually with thinking, I'm not good enough the way I am, and I've come here to Abhayagiri in order to practice meditation to become better, to attain levels of concentration, to become a stream enterer or become an arahant. I want to become something, want the jhanas, I want the states, the stages. I want to, and then there's vipavodana, the desire to get rid of your defilements, your faults, your weaknesses, your greed, your anger, your delusions, desire to get rid of. And so this is not about getting rid of desires, like trying to get rid of desires, another form of desire. So there's no hope in that direction. just trying to destroy, deny, and reject. Desire is and dukkha are pretty much the same thing. So it's understanding, recognizing, observing desire. And it's very clearly stated in the as a cause of suffering. To observe it, you have to accept it, like sense desire or desire for becoming something, to get something you don't have yet, like maybe it's a very good thing you want. But that's bhavadana, desire for becoming, vipavadana, desire to get rid of your fear or your anger or lust or your faults. So that's the Bharati Dhamma again. There's this cause of suffering. And what to do about it is to let go of desire or abandon desire or release yourself by recognizing desire. Then you have that insight. You recognizing desire when you're attached to it, it's suffering. It's the cause of suffering. Desire in itself isn't the cause of suffering. It's the ignorance and attachment to it that is the cause. So in trying to get rid of desires is a hopeless task, because that's another desire. It's like just go around in circles with that. But because desire is a mind object, it comes and goes. It's not permanent. It arises when the conditions for gamma, danha, sense desire arise, then that's what you experience. When desire for becoming something, trying to get something you don't have that you want to become, when the conditions for that arise, then that desire manifests. And same with vipavadana, desire to get rid of what you don't like. So recognize that the Buddha was emphasizing sati sampatthana, mindfulness, awareness, a total acceptance of desire, not through attaching to it, but through recognizing. And so we point here to this, like in the Kuba Ajahns in northeast Thailand always point to their heart, you know, dujit, kwam jing yuti ni, and things like this are ways that they express that you're not trying to destroy desire, otherwise destroy the planet, but to understand it and then to let go of it. And through this sati sampajanya, through mindfulness and intuitive awareness or clear comprehension, it's our ability to really observe something totally without trying to do anything about it. It is what it is, that we let go of that desire. And so it's not a destruction, not a denial, not a rejection, but we release our blind attachment to desires, those three kinds of desires. So then, the Bharati Dhamma, there is an origin. The Bhati Bhat is to let go, abandon, and the Bhati Wait is the insight. The three kinds of desire have been abandoned, have been let go of. So letting go is not like suppressing. To let go of something doesn't mean you throw it away. It means you just put it down, you know. So you're attached to something, you don't have to throw it out. You just set it down, release your grip on it. So it's letting go, abandoning desire, letting desire be what it is. And then you'll witness its desire ceases. Desire has no permanent ability to sustain itself. So then re-emphasizing these three aspects, there is the cause of suffering, the practice to let go of the cause, and the insight is it has been let go of. Desire has been abandoned. And then that takes us to the third noble truth of Nirodha, which is the cessation. Suffering ceases. And we're now aware of the Bharati statement, there is the end of desire, the cessation of desire, of suffering. What to do about it is to make it clear, make it very consciously aware of non-attachment. The end of when desire, when you've released your blind hold and grip on desire, desire then ceases. And that cessation is to be developed and made clear, to be realized, to be made real. So it's not just a kind of fantasy or some kind of difficult thing to do. It's just a matter of recognizing, realizing non-attachment is like this. So the three aspects, when you actually have made it very clear, this Nirodha, the truth of Nirodha, or the end of suffering is like this, then that's the insight. Leads on to Samaditti, the fourth noble truth. Fourth noble truth then is based on right understanding or perfect understanding. And it comes through this sequence of the Four Noble Truths. So it's based on wisdom, not on just ideas of wisdom or what somebody tells you is wise or what you should be doing. It's the real insight, gut knowledge, profound understanding is Samaditti, Samasangapo. This comes from wisdom, from universal wisdom, from pure conscious knowing, not from knowledge you acquire from taking philosophy courses or reading scriptures or profound philosophy from great philosophers of the past, but it's really knowing, because wisdom is available to us when we let go, when we no longer bind ourselves out of ignorance to conditioned phenomena. And from there, then, is to develop, to cultivate, bhavana. The Bhatibhata is bhavana. Then that's what that word actually means. It's a kind of catchword used generally in Thai for meditation, but it's really developing the Eightfold Path, cultivating this through Samaditti, Samasangapo. It affects our speech, our action, livelihood, then the effort, mindfulness and concentration are in balance. You know, so there's an equanimity, there's a balance, a sense of knowing, from profound knowing rather than from knowing about Dhamma. You know Dhamma, you know the ultimate reality. Now, the greatness of this teaching lies in it takes the most ordinary human experience. And then from that, we realize ultimate reality. We realize, recognize Dhamma. We awaken to reality. We see for ourselves. So it's not something that you're no longer just bound to the Bharati Dhamma level of, because the Buddha wrote, you know, gave this sermon that you have to believe in it. It's not about that. It's not about a belief system, but a very skillful way to practice to find out, to recognize yourself, these Four Noble Truths. So this day particular on the Sala Puja day is the day we can remind ourselves of what this really implies, and to increase our determination to develop it, to cultivate it. So in my own experience over the years, this will be my 48th Panta, or 48th Vasa, as a bhikkhu this year. And so that's quite a long time. I've had this great opportunity to put this into practice. And of course, when I met Lumpa Cha in Thailand years ago, 1967, I could really appreciate the way he taught, because this was what he was actually teaching. He was teaching exactly the Four Noble Truths. This is what at first I didn't understand the language, so there was a problem there. But through time, I could understand, the language well enough to benefit from his formal talks and reflections. But then even before that, there was something more going on. It was a kind of intuitive awareness, a whole lifestyle that was based on this awakened attention to the reality of the here and now, the present moment. Then over the years, this developing, this cultivating this way of life is a rare opportunity for us, because most of us are not from Buddhist countries. We're Phrungs, and have a whole different cultural conditioning, than, say, the Thai monks or Sri Lankan monks have. And so I've always marveled at my good fortune to have come across Buddhism in the first place, and to be able to take an interest in to feel a sense of real interest in even my first introduction to Buddhism, which was through Zen Buddhism. And then over the years, the development of the practice within the form, the traditional structure that we inherited from the time the Buddha gave his first sermon, when he informed his five colleagues about the Four Noble Truths and establishing Dhamma and Vinaya in a way that holds this form has lasted through 2,500 years, which is quite profound when you think of it, that any tradition that we can trace in our life through our own cultural backgrounds that goes back 2,557 years. Can't think of any. And wonder what was happening here at Bayagiri 2,557 years ago. One can only speculate. But we consider it an ancient religion. But it's not ancient, it's a timeless teaching, because it's about something we can relate to, no matter what cultural background we have, what our even religious background might be, or our own experience of life, isn't it? It's something that we can all recognize quite easily, suffering. Some people think that monastic life is a lot of suffering. Thing. We have all these rules of we have to keep, and we can't eat dinner in the evening. And some people think, I don't know how you can spend 48 years without dinner. or brahmacharya celibacy. How do you manage that one, for 48 years? And you must really suffer a lot. But you don't suffer if you really examine suffering, because we create suffering. It's ignorance and desire that are the causes of suffering. Like celibacy, we can make that into suffering by, not wanting it, or resenting it, or not feeling we're pure enough or comparing ourselves with ideals of purity and never feeling quite good enough. No, we tend to feel guilt-ridden, anxiety-ridden, and we blame this maybe on the celibate life or the Vinaya discipline. Or is it the cause of suffering, or do we create suffering around the Vinaya discipline? One thing I really enjoyed about living in Thailand in those beginning years was that Thai people, like in where we lived in Ubon in Isan, northeast Thailand, they have a kind of acceptance of the human condition that was quite new to me, because being an American, I was never told to accept the human condition, but always to try to improve it. You know, there's something wrong with this human condition, and we've got to do something about it, make it better. We've got to always make ourselves better because we're not good enough. And so the bookshops in airports are filled with self-improvement, books on how to improve yourself, make yourself better, and all kinds of things. Because most of us are brought up with the idea that we're not good enough the way we are, and that we've got to do something about it, otherwise we're going to be failures. And in the American culture, being a failure is the ultimate disgrace, ultimate failure. Where in Thailand, I noticed Lungpa Cha and the monks I trained with were accepting the human condition more. They said, that's the way it is, you know. We have these desires. We want to have beautiful objects, and we don't like ugly things, and we have sexual desires, and we have anger, and we're jealous, and we have a lot of fear, and this is the human condition. And it's a kind of, not saying that's all there is, but it's pointing out that being human on planet Earth at this time is like this. Having a body, a male body or a female body is like this. Having youth or old age is like this. And this way of not saying anything about being good or bad, but it is the way it is. And our relationship to our own physical forms then changes from vanity and self-criticism to awareness and understanding, awakening to reality or awakening to Dhamma. This realm, you know, when you look at it, it always amazes me that we actually have a way of transcending it, of breaking out of the momentum of desires and habits that we've acquired. Because in one way it seems hopeless. Because on our personalities, the sense of ourself is based on ignorance. You know, like whatever you think you are, believe you are as a person, is that view is created out of avidya or ignorance. It's not ultimately true. And so we suffer a lot because we believe our own minds too much. We believe what we think. We believe all kinds of delusions that we're committed to as person, as people, as personalities. We're culturally programmed in various ways. You know, so whatever society, whatever class you're born into, working class or middle class, upper class, you identified with that position, with a religion of some sort, or with no religion. Identified with, whether you're American or you're not, or you're European or Asian. We're all identified with these cultural conditions that are programmed into us after we're born. We're not born Americans or we're not born thinking, I'm a little boy. I was born, you know, physical form, human form, consciousness. These are natural conditions. And the sense of myself being a male baby didn't occur to me till later on. Not something you get right off when you come out of your mother's womb. You have consciousness, though. Consciousness isn't about culture. You have physical form, male or female form. That's natural phenomena. You know, and then the personality develops through these attachments to these perceptions we get from mother or father or society in general. And then language, another thing. We have our language. We're not born speaking English or Thai or any other language. These languages we learn, and they're all based on avijja, not knowing reality. You know, they have their point, they have their purpose, but we are very attached to thinking and language and definitions of forms. We want our reality depends, our sense of security and reality depends on identifying forms. And this is right, this is wrong, this is good, this is bad, this is a microphone, this is a clock, this is a man, a woman, and so forth. We feel secure through definition. And so then these forms become our reality. And so the only way we can get beyond these conditions is through awareness of them. You know, this is what the Buddha emphasized over and over again. So the first three fetters, this is in the Bharatidhamma again, first three fetters, there are 10 fetters, the first three are all made by human beings. They're not natural conditions. They're artifices. They're creations by human beings out of ignorance. So that's the ego, the sense of yourself, sakyaditti, sila bhatta-paramasa, which is like cultural, social conditioning, conventions that you acquire through your parents and society, and then vichikicca, which is doubt, which is always the result of attachment to thinking. Thinking will always create, the end of thought will always be not certain, unsure, doubt, vichikicca. So what is the way to escape these fetters is through mindfulness. And it's not through denying or rejecting, but knowing sakyaditti, really knowing the ego, observing it. That which is aware of the sense of self is not self. Awareness is not personal. It's not mine or yours. And so when we're aware in the present moment, it's not a personal ability, but we can be aware of personality. You know, you see it. You have to think to become a person. I have to think, you know, to become Ajahn Sumedho, I have to think I'm Ajahn Sumedho. And when I don't think, I'm not thinking that very often, in fact. It's not an obsession. Conventionally speaking, you say he's Ajahn Sumedho, but actually there's no Ajahn Sumedho most of the time. It's changing other thoughts that come and go and change. So on a conventional level, it's okay. You know, you say that's Ajahn Sumedho and that conventional skillful use of convention and name and that you use for conventional reality, but conventional society, but ultimate truth is there's no self, there's no Ajahn Sumedho, no person, there's conditions changing. And so really reflect on how you create yourself through identifying with your body, your appearance, your age, your gender, your position, your social position, your memories, thoughts, emotions, they're all me and mine. And in the present day, in a country like this, everyone's obsessed with themselves. As you know, we're so interested in why we feel fear, or why I suffer guilt, or why I'm so anxious, or why do I get angry so easily? Why? What's wrong with me that I should be like this? And we become obsessed with trying to find out why I suffer. And it's not about why, it's just noticing suffering is like this. You don't need to know why. You just trust yourself to recognize dukkha, or conditions, sankharas, phenomena that you actually can recognize in this present moment. The body's like this, the sitting posture, the four iribata, the sitting, standing, walking, lying down, ordinary movements of a human body throughout the day and night. The breathing, inhaling, exhaling, is like this. Your own mental, emotional state is like this. And you start recognizing, maybe you're feeling doubtful, uncertain, intimidated, happy, inspired, whatever you're feeling, you can be aware of it. It comes and goes. So then this is about all conditions are impermanent. Sape sankharani cha. And those who practice vipassana meditation have this all the time. We are reminded about all conditions are impermanent. All dhamma, sape tama ananta, all dhamma is not self. There's no self in ultimate reality. Ultimate reality then is not about becoming enlightened, but in being awake and aware, in developing, cultivating awareness, and trusting it, and reflecting on the changing conditions that we're experiencing, whether they be coarse or subtle, whatever their quality might be. The Buddha made it very simple. All conditions are impermanent, no exceptions. There's no condition that is permanent. Then what is it that can observe conditions? Can one condition know another? You know, is it, can my right hand know my left hand? Or can, you know, is there a special condition that knows? And then other conditions don't know, and then we get tangled up with thinking again. You know, trying to figure it out with theories or ideas or opinions that we form. But sati sampajanya is our ability to be aware of conditioned phenomena. And that's not conditioned phenomena. Awareness then is the, what we say, the gate or the door to the deathless, amata dhamma, to ultimate reality, awakened to that reality itself. And that's not a condition. The dhamma is not a condition that comes and goes. It's here now, ever present, but we may never notice it because we're so involved, interested, or repelled by the conditions we're experiencing. Now, this way of talking is an encouragement. It's not a kind of dogmatic teaching, because the last thing I want you is just to say, Ajahn Sumedho says, and then you believe what I say. The point of this whole effort this evening is to encourage you to test it out yourself. You know, it's up to you whether what you do with it. But it is available, like here at Vaigiri, Tanajan Pasano, his endeavors to establish this monastery is to make this something that is available, that you can actually come here and train as monks or as lay people. You can hear and get more kind of encouragement in your practice of meditation. We do need encouragement because we can easily be discouraged because of the trickiness, the slipperiness of our own minds can really entangle us and delude us. So we do need encouragement. And this is what these kind of centers, these places are for. It's developing this ancient traditional form, not to preserve some kind of nice and antique for the future, but it's about you learning how to use this form to awaken to reality. And how you use this form then is up to you, because it's presented here in a very pure way. It's not corrupted. It's available for anyone who seeks it, and then to develop it, cultivate it yourself, that's up to you, what you do with it. So I offer this as an encouragement, hopefully, and a reflection on this auspicious day, full moon of July, Asala Puja, and may you all benefit and increase your confidence, faith in the Buddha Dhamma Sangha.
Andamayang Dhammakataya Sadhu Karang Dadamase
Sadhu Sadhu.